Let's go back and have you tell more about your family coming to California.
Yeah. The father of my great-grandfather, evidently, I'm speculating a little now, but I think they wanted to get him away from the Civil War, which was imminent to break out, and he would have been conscripted, and he was the only male in the inherited line of our family. So his father went out in 1851 to look over San Francisco, found out there was a very good medical school out there, and he came back and told his son he wanted him to go out there. We seem to have been able to trace that he went down to New Orleans, and the only reason he would go to New Orleans would be to cross the Isthmus of the Canal and go up to that was one way to do it, rather than go all the way around California, Southern California. Mm-hmm. So I think that's how he got to San Francisco and met Dr. Toland and became his star pupil. This is speculation.
Let me just turn it on. So tell me more about your grandfather.
Right. We're assuming from some evidence that we have that the three brothers, his two uncles and his father, decided that he should go down to New Orleans and then go over to the Isthmus of Canal, the Panama, before the canal, and went across the land and took the ship up to San Francisco. That was the short route. And it got him there in time to get into school before the war broke out. Mm-hmm. They were terrified that he was going to get conscripted.
Yeah.
And he was just too brilliant. He was really, really a smart guy. And he turned out to be a superb surgeon. I found medical papers that he wrote for various journals, and I copied the two or three that I found. So those are in the records at the Historical Society, or here, I don't know which. Historical Society, that's probably where I have all my genealogy stuff.
Okay, well, your family, it's fascinating, and it's really good to learn about it.
I was so excited to hear about Dr. Toland and how he kept him after he graduated to make him his assistant, that I went over to the archives of the University of California Medical School in San Francisco, and I went to the archivist and I said, "Do you retain any photographs of the early classes?" And he went off someplace and came back and said, "Yes, we have them all the way back." And I said, "I need the second year graduating people."
Oh my.
He brought out a little fat photo album, and there's my great-grandfather there, with his name written underneath his picture. The family had never seen it, didn't know it existed, and it established clearly that he was graduated from the University of California Medical School.
It's wonderful.
It was called Toland Medical School, and it changed its name this third year, I think. Became the universities.
And it was the
most advanced, sophisticated medical school.
Well, University of California, San Francisco.
Toland started his medical school.
It's still.
I think the University of California were watching Toland and realized that he was doing very advanced surgical procedures. So they just absorbed him into their system.
Because it's a wonderful school.
Oh, it's supposed to be the best in the West.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Probably even more than the West.
Well, for my great-grandfather to go down to San Diego and start the medical society down there and be the leading doctor in the community, long enough that they gave him the county hospital. He ran the county hospital for years. And then he signed the city charter after that. I mean, he was a major player in the city.
Absolutely.
Much beloved.
And you are going to now get back to junior high school.
Okay, but before I do that, I'm going to surprise you.
Okay.
I don't know if we're going to use it or not.
That's okay.
But Dr. Fenn had a patient in the Bay Area, a mother who had three boys, and two of them were fine, and one of them had some medical problem. And she brought him into San Francisco and took him to Dr. Fenn before he came down to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Fenn evidently treated him.
Mm-hmm.
She was married at the time, but I think separated from her husband, who was an Irishman. McNutt was his name. And he was an alcoholic. And he owned a ranch outside of Santa Barbara. And she fled him because I think he beat her, ran away from her. She was 1/4 Choctaw, 25% Canadian French, and I think who was a fur trapper, and 50% probably English. I have to straighten that out now. But I like to make jokes about, if you are a certified member of almost any of the Indian tribes, and you have at least 1/8 blood in your DNA, right, you can collect money.
I know.
And so I told my sister and friends, I said, I'm 1/16, so I'm cut out of the deal, but I take great pride in being, we're almost certain it's Choctaw, because of where they ended up in Oklahoma. But anyway, so there's a, and when you see a photograph of Dr. Finn's wife, he looks like he's 5'5", he's a little guy, and she looks like she's 6 feet tall, and she's frowning, and she is a big woman. But I think a lot of the family thought that she was probably some border illiterate Indian squaw that he found someplace. Well, it turns out she published beautiful poems in literary magazines in San Francisco, and she wrote excellent letters and stuff. I was desperate to find out what happened, how they got together, and what happened to her former husband.
Yeah.
And I went to the Historical Society during the summer, and the librarian that I always worked with was not there. So they had a volunteer woman who was, you know, comes in and helps when they need help. And so I explained what I wanted very carefully to her, with no hopes that she would find anything that we hadn't already found. And I'm sitting out in the research room working on something else, and she's back in the stacks. She disappeared. And then she calls out to me. It was a very quiet day. There was almost nobody there. She said, "Mr. Brown, I'm looking at a bunch of documents here. Does Archambault mean anything to you?" And I said, "Archambault? What are you looking at?" "Oh, these are the divorce papers of a Dr. Finn for his wife that wanted to marry him, and it's all the divorce records." I mean, it was like money fell out of the sky.
Oh,
I leaped over the counter and went back there, and she had the complete divorce records of my great-grandfather and how we helped his former husband, who was not a nice man, he was a wild Irishman. And what they did was, they got attorneys, and they filed divorce papers in San Diego, and they were required by this California law that he had to have 90 days or something to respond. And when he didn't respond, we had his address, then they proceeded with the divorce, and it was finalized in San Diego. And that he was able to marry this Indian woman.
That's a great story.
I mean, the whole thing is a giant melodrama.
That's terrific.
And wait till you see the picture of her. And he was a 33rd degree Mason. He didn't go to 34th. Got to 33rd. I'm surprised the Masons even let him in with a woman of mixed blood. Because they were very snooty people.
Yeah.
They were the high-end conservative businessmen.
I know. Yeah.
Okay. I probably fouled up your proceedings.
No, we didn't, because that's a very... We're getting back to your historical roots, and that's good. But now we're coming into junior high school, where in addition to your ongoing, continuous book collecting and doing jobs outside of school and all, you were in, I believe, clubs. And of course, you were a good student, but you mentioned something about a club where you had a story to tell about a young man who you helped to get into a club.
To get into what?
Into a club, or was a group.
Oh, the Black Boy. Well, at Woodrow Wilson Junior High School, it was very socially structured. And poor kids, even if they were good students and nice people, were kind of pushed aside. And of course, sports is everything to kids in junior high school. And so all the athletes and the friends of the athletes and the in guys with the girls were in this sports club. But they left out the most outstanding athlete in the entire school by a country mile, who's black. He could run faster and throw further and hit harder and do whatever you needed to do. And it was very clear they didn't take him in because he was black. So I, in a blind fury, went to three or four of my friends, Lee was one of Robert Lee, or not Robert Lee, but a guy named, last name was Lee, and the fellow that we can't find, but we might find his wife.
Donald Ward.
Ward. And now we're tracking his wife. We hope to find her, Compass Menace, and, and tucked away her tiger, because she may have the only copy in the
of
world.
The tiger, Jane.
So we formed a club. I think it was about six or seven of us. And this kid, and our photograph was taken. Every club in the junior high school had a page. And so here was a picture of us all grinning and smiling, youthful, happy people, and this black kid. And it was the most satisfying thing I can't say ever did, but one of the most.
That was terrific.
Because when he went home to tell his family, you can imagine.
Right. They must have been so delighted.
They found it unbelievable.
Right.
And to have his picture in the yearbook?
That was great. Well, that was a terrific thing.
I'm going to find one of those if it's the last thing I do.
Well, we're going to work at it.
What I might do is go on the internet and offer $50. Somebody's liable to steal it out of the library. Has anybody ever checked the San Diego, the SDSU for it? Did you actually process that? Because I might have given my copy to them. I just think a lot of things are buried here.
That's probably true.
Remember, you were standing here when I asked him if he had the photographs of Jacqueline Onassis and other people.
Right.
Because they're, I told my sister, I said, I only have one or two pictures with Jacqueline Onassis. She said, you're dead wrong. I said, why do you tell me that? You sent me 36 cartons of genealogy and they were in there.
Oh.
And I said, well, give me copies then. I don't believe you. So she did. I was in a couple of magazines that I didn't even remember.
I want to see them.
Their picture. I might have even brought them with me, but I don't have them with me right now.
Well, is there anything else you want to discuss about junior high school before we get into Hoover High School?
About what now?
Anything else about junior? Anything else about the junior high before we proceed to the high school?
Well, I was very concerned about my sister still. My brother was on his own pretty much. I ran into Miss Minson. That's the one I wanted to talk about.
Yes,
I just thought it was another English class. Boy, was I wrong. This was obviously the 25 or 30 best students at Woodrow Wilson to take a dunk into the La Brea tar pits of American English grammar. She was terrifying. She'd get up there on the floor and she'd do all these conjugations and sentence structures and stuff, and then she'd start calling names and nobody knew what she was talking about.
Yeah.
She was obviously, don't do that, but she wanted everybody to know that I'm in charge and you are going to learn this or I'm going to flunk you. And it's the closest I ever came to getting a B. She had me on the B-plus list for half the course and I was just very unhappy about it.
Yeah.
But I finally, on the final test, but she just beat it into us. And she repeated it. She called on people. She was terrifying. So she was the one we hated. And now I have to
remember her.
Now I respect her because she taught me everything I needed to know about writing a declarative sentence.
Yeah.
And I catch kids in graduate school now that can't write a declarative sentence.
Yes.
I mean, it's shocking.
Yes.
In my fraternity, I was bombarded with pre-meds. The guys were going to be doctors. They could study science and all of that, but they couldn't write.
Right.
They absolutely couldn't write a declarative sentence.
Yeah, well, it goes
on. And the engineers had a pretty tough time with it, too.
Well.
No, I was doing a lot of counseling in college with my fraternity brothers.
So let's go from junior high school to high school and talk about your high school experiences, your friendships, etc.
Well, the nice thing about high school was that it was bigger, and we met more people, and it had a more diversified curriculum, and it was more of a challenge and more interesting. And I made a lot of very good friends there. We certainly weren't accepted socially. None of the three of us in my family were just too poor. Mm-hmm. They were below the university line, you might say. It was just structured. And it had a great deal to do with the woman at Woodrow Wilson that ran the student paper and then she passed along all of her attitudes about the kids coming in at Hoover. And there was a woman at Hoover who taught a social studies class or something that was kind of vague, and she gathered all the richest kids in Talmadge and Kensington into that class. She was just running a party.
That's terrible.
And moving people like pieces on a chessboard.
That's just
a despicable woman.
That's awful.
Well, they had a club called the Achievers, which was the honor club your junior year at Hoover. And Sally Kay and I, who had put in more service hours than anybody in the school, we didn't take study classes. We gave that to the office to kind of back up the clerical work and stuff.
Yeah.
We organized the entertainment programs. We did a lot of stuff. We certainly should have been in the Achievers. 10 men and 10 women.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of us got in. So we sat down, absolutely astonished that this woman would have that kind of control. There were people on that list who were second-string football players, but they were popular with the girls, so she put them in Achievers. So Sally and I, and she had a wonderful heart. She was the apple of my eye in high school. That's another straight story, but anyway, she and I decided to throw in a formal complaint. So we sat down and we wrote a memorandum to the principal showing all of our service hours, which were astronomical because we did it. And it was all documented. And one of them's mother was a secretary, and her son was in Achievers, and she knew what was going on. And when she saw our memorandum, she told me, "You're absolutely right. There's no excuse for you and Sally not being in." And she said, "This letter is going to cause quite a turmoil." And so at the end of the year, in the graduation ceremony, they announced the 5 outstanding students in the class. Now you've got 10 boys and 10 girls in Achievers. And Sally and I were 2 of the 5.
Hmm.
And only one girl who was in Achievers got in. Her name was Gleason, something Gleason. And she was a superstar. She's just beautiful and smart and did things without bragging or anything. She was just, and I forgot who did. But there they are, the 5 names. 2 girls and 3 guys, I think it was. And so the principal obviously took charge and gave us that honor, which was very important to us because it was time they cleaned up this Kensington Talmadge clique that they had going.
Sounds like it.
And it was very, very apparent.
And weren't you the valedictorian?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
It says that in the program, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And what else?
And that was not done. You know, when you look up the valedictory definition, because I said I wasn't first in the class, I didn't have straight A's on every course. My penmanships were B's and C's.
Yeah.
It was very annoying. So I went and asked them about this.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, "Well, no, we picked the valedictorian speaker who has a combination of what we think is the well-rounded person in the class who can also speak."
Ah.
Because you could bring in somebody who is a superstar and they're shy, and they would make a disaster out of the commencement.
Yeah.
It was right here in this little, what's the old name for that little bowl that I pointed out to
what
you?
What is it? You would know better than me, Jane.
It's now the Outdoor Theater. It used to have a name.
I don't know.
Well, that's way, way back. Doesn't matter anyway. But that's where we had our commencement program.
Yeah.
And that's where I gave my commencement address. Robes of Responsibility. Is that corny? I remember it well. My mother was living in L.A. with my younger sister, and she sent me a Hamilton watch.
Oh, yes.
She didn't come down for
it. I know Hamilton watches.
She didn't come down for the ceremony. My father didn't show up.
Oh, boy.
My sister and brother certainly came. And all the girls in our neighborhood over where we lived, south of university, they were just ecstatic.
That's
giggling,
great.
And jumping up and down and screaming.
That's
like
great.
I'd won the final pass to win the football game.
Well.
And I was embarrassed by it. I mean, I said, "Calm down."
Well.
Anyway.
It's terrific.
I told you about the company that I worked for during junior high school, decrating all the things so they could be sold. That was a block away from home, so that was convenient for me.
Yeah.
But I had to rush home every day be home by, you know, 3:30 to 4:15 to get these things done before the store closed at 5:30 or 6. And sometimes it was a close call. But I was a hard worker.
Clearly.
And I didn't mind hard work because the things I did, I liked.
Yeah.
We had two old ladies in the neighborhood who were drawing a car that must have been issued in 1928. They were still drawing this beautiful old car.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived about three blocks away. And they used to chug along past our house so they could wave at my sister and brother and me. And they were both like really old, 70, 75. And I turned their front yard into a paradise garden. And they were so thrilled. They probably gave me $5 instead of $3 or something.
Yeah.
But they stuck with me for 4 or 5 years, 6 years maybe.
That's great.
And I had other people in the neighborhood who did that too. But I loved doing that. That wasn't that horrible cutting the brush in the summer. That was awful.
Yeah.
It really was.
Well,
but $1 an hour was a lot of money. At the end of the day, we earned $6 or $7 each. That's, we go home and give my mother $12 or $14. That was important.
Right.
So we had to do it.
Well,
we had terrible sunburns and sprains and scratches, and it was rough. It's some kind of a, there's a name for the bush, and it's got a lot of prickly things on it, and it grows so that it comes up from the ground about 2 or 3 feet, so you can slide under it and cut it off at the ground. So we were down there in this dirt on this steep hill, cutting the base of these bushes, because they all had to be taken out, or all the houses above would have been burned out if there was a fire.
Hmm.
Anyway.
Are there any friends or other teachers in your high school that you want to talk about?
Well, my counselor was my guardian angel, Miss Ingebrigtsen. Miss Emil, she was the debate coach.
Okay.
Very proper lady, very formal, very pleasant. And the school clearly did something for her. They gave her the classroom at the end of the hall on the second floor, so we had all windows, beautiful views, and the room was bigger than most classrooms, and we were the pick of the school.
Yeah.
All the debaters and the super smart people were in that class, maybe 25 to 35 people. And we had a big outdoor area. You could step out of the room, and there was a big cul-de-sac there, kind of a dead end, that was about half the size of this room. So we could have somebody outside working on their debates and people inside too. And she was very careful, very persistent, and coached us very well, and we just beat everybody. It was wonderful.
That's terrific.
And the kids at Hoover were very respectful about that. They loved scenes like, it wasn't as exciting as the football team winning, but to say that we knocked off all 7 schools that participated in a tournament in San Diego County was pretty impressive to them.
That is.
And then the reason that I really, really wanted to go to San Diego State was because they had the most renowned and respected debate and forensics coach in the country, John Ackley, A-C-K-L-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And John was the sweetest, gentlest, kindest, soft-spoken person. You would never believe that he would be a good debate coach because it's all verbal punching, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we bring in the top senior with the top senior women's debate team and the top senior men and throw them into the pit, and they would give their latest cases.
Yeah.
And John would sit there taking voluminous notes, and then in the sweetest, kindest way, he would take us apart. You can't say this, and you're contradicting yourself there, and this is not a complete thought. But he didn't say that way. He had a sweet tone. He taught at Sunday school. He was that kind of a person. Very nice guy. I think he was having an affair with the unmarried history teacher that we all love too, but we can't put that in there because they were always together. They went to church together, they went to movies together. Anyway, but John Ackley was, in my opinion, the finest public speakers, debate forensics coach in the country at the time. I mean, or close to it, I mean. When you knock off UCLA and USC and COP was a big school at the time and that, and Stanford and Berkeley and other people along the way, you gotta be good. We had, what, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 students at the time? That's amazing. And there were a lot of kids that had the same talents, but there was nobody to coach them.
Makes
nobody
a difference.
To teach them.
Teachers
It's like, what could happen to that black girl if she hadn't had me for speech, and
that's
she
right.
had one of the really the unpleasant people.
Right.
She would have left every day crying.
Well, Jane is not, we're
see,
all
this
teachers.
Is, this is the roll of the dice in life, you know, and some people get a break and some don't.
Well, the other thing, and you had a scholarship to San Diego State did you?
Well, I had a paid scholarship. After winning all those tournaments, they were chasing after me.
That's great.
I also applied at three or four other schools, but I ignored them. I wanted to go to state. I wanted John Ackley.
Okay.
Probably more than he wanted me, because I was determined to be, you know, top of the heap, at least by my junior, senior year.
Okay, now...
And I told you I jumped Tony McPeak out of the lower division and moved him up to the senior division so he could be my debate partner my senior year. And we... The greatest... 18 Western states, and we went through about 9 debate rounds, and it was tied at that point between USC and San Diego State. And we won it 5-4, 9 judges.
Wow.
5-4.
Tell me about Tony McPeak and who he was in your life.
Well, Tony was an absolute phenomenon. He was soft-spoken. He had kind of a hoarse voice. He didn't have a commanding voice. He was tall and lean and sort of had a Lincoln look to him. He knew he was good, but he didn't show it. He was very careful about laying low. But he was in El Cajon High School. There wasn't anybody in El Cajon High School that could coach. We would have known about him. But he would enter poetry interpretation, impromptu, extemporary speaking, oratory, and maybe one other that I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
He would enter all of them and win all of them. First place. Boom, 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 boom. He did this he was 2 years behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we were having the all county forensics competition at San Diego State, which is how we got a lot of good debaters. Because we did a lot of research,
mm-hmm.
and we found out who were the smartest kids at the school, who got straight A's, who was politically aware, all those things. And we were hosting the competition, so we were listening to these kids from the high schools. And when we found somebody that was good, we went after them. I mean, we pushed. We were soliciting them to be in a fraternity or a sorority.
Yeah.
Only we want their brains.
Yeah.
The social graces.
Right.
And Ada Pekarsen was another famous one. Ada was our strongest female speaker for quite a few years. And she's now Ada Pekarsen Sands, S-A-N-D-S. And she and her husband formed a fairly successful, prominent law firm in L.A.
That makes sense.
I talked to her maybe 3 years ago. And I did call her and tell her that we had found some pictures in the Aztec, which I have not had the privilege of seeing yet, of... They have digitally copied the Aztec paper,
mm-hmm.
and I actually saw those. Somebody showed them to me once when I was here, of pictures of the debate teams, the junior year that we won so many other tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
They did a whole feature on us, and I'd love to see that.
Well, I think they're working on it. So.
And I told Ada that if I found the pictures, I would send them to her. She was very excited about that. And they had Tony in there and Eleanor Moskowitz and other people.
And also, I think you mentioned the Student Council and John Baldessari.
Well, when I got out to San Diego State, I wanted to get into politics of the student government right away.
Mm-hmm.
And the structure was the Student Council.
Yeah.
And that's what ran everything, especially if you can form a political bloc.
Mm-hmm.
It's very political.
Uh-huh.
So the Sigma Chi's had gotten together with Zeta Beta Tau, the Jewish fraternity, who had a lot of smart guys in there. And we said, whenever an issue's coming up on the agenda, let's sit down and see if we can have a meeting of the minds, because if we can, we want to form a bloc to be sure it gets through on a majority.
Mm-hmm.
So we really kind of ran the place, to a large extent. And What was the question you just asked?
I just said that it was John Baldessari.
Oh, Baldessari was 2 years ahead of me, and he was the senior representative. I was the freshman, sophomore, junior, senior. Okay. I got all 4 years. I ran on a ballot. I'm not sure I came in first every time. Well, I would have to come in first, or I wouldn't have been on the board. But I was on it all 4 years. Joe Rosa from Point Loma was the president the last year, Sigma Chi, and one or two others on the board. But we didn't run it for our own benefit. We ran it, we wanted it, like the money had to be divided to go to the right people. And if you had the wrong people on that, it would all go to football or basketball,
yeah,
or volleyball or something. And it's already, they get some of that, but not all of it. And the dean became our best friend because he saw what we were doing. We were bringing democracy to the student government. And we fought for it when we were having problems. The other fraternities detested Sigma Chi because we so dominated the campus. We really didn't get along. Like, we had our annual Hawaii party. We had an annual Hawaii party where we all wore the same Hawaii shirt all over campus.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And we had about 100 members. So you saw these 100 guys, yeah, who were usually looking better than average. They weren't hobos or anything. And we're all saying the same of shirts.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had it at the Hotel Del Coronado. But we had a lot of trouble with the Kappa Sigs. They were out to make trouble with us whenever they could. So we formed a committee to go over and meet with the people at the hotel and with the Coronado Police Department and anybody else we thought. We got some Coronado police to come and police the party that night, in not in uniforms, but just, you know, standing around. Well, everything went fine for about 2 or 3 hours. And then the Kappa Sig, somebody blew a whistle or hit a gong, and they took all of the pool furniture and threw it in the pool. They poured bottles of beer and wine into the water. They did everything they could to wreck the party, and they wrecked it. The hotel closed it down. We got called before the authorities at school. It was very, very scary, but I was smart enough to do all this preliminary work, and I had all the records, because I expected they might try something that we couldn't. And I showed how we hired, we met with the Coronado Police Department, we hired them in plain clothes, we met with the authorities at the hotel, we had people working just guard duty, they didn't bring dates. We tried everything we could, but we couldn't control these 75 drunk lunatics from Kappa Sig who wanted to wreck our party and get us kicked off campus. Mm-hmm. So we were put on probation, but we got compliments from the administration that we had put up a concerted effort to try to maintain civil conduct, but we weren't able to control it, so they had to do something. So they said, we're going to put you on 1 semester of probation, but then it went away right away.
Oh, good.
But that kind of thing I don't want to put in there. That's retribution with the Kappa Sigs. They were a bunch of bastards, but...
Well, we'll...
But I don't want to get into that. I'm sorry.
Well, let's go on.
It shows that we were a conscientious group as well. We did dominate the political machine along with Zeta Paul, whatever they are, Zeta Beta Tau. But I don't want to brag about that.
Okay. Well, as when you were at San Diego State, and you were so active and involved between the fraternities and debating, what about literature? That's always been part of your life. Did you?
Literature?
Yeah. Were you studying?
Well, I took the courses in the best teachers. I mean, there were a couple teachers that were kind of dullards, and I avoided them. My freshman year, you never saw the Quonsonettes, did you ever? Okay, they're these metal roofs that were created in World War II, and they're rounded like that. And they were between the old theater in the quad. We called it the quad. It was that little square there in front of the library.
Right.
Between the theater, which we had a small theater that faced right on the quad, and the library over here. And between that, they had set up 3 Quonset huts about 6 back. And that's where they held the freshman English classes.
Oh.
And it was like being boiled in oil. It was so goddamn hot in those things.
Oh, wow.
And who did I have? He was an Englishman. And he turned out to be a published poet and a good one. And his first assignment, and we were all scared to death and would have to write an essay in a college class, we'll all get killed. But I had Miss Minson in my background.
Ah.
And he said, you have to pick a word and write an essay about it. And I chose curiosity.
Oh, great.
because that's really where my head was.
Yeah.
And I used an introductory story, which I had read somewhere, that there was an island someplace in the Pacific where they liked to catch the monkeys, probably for pets or something, who knows. I don't want to think beyond that, so we'll say pets. And what they did was they would take a coconut and they would hollow it out, and then they would put a stone in there that fit through the hole. And the monkeys were so curious that they heard that rattling around, and they would reach through the hole and grab a hold of whatever that was, which they didn't know what they had in their hand could be food. And they were so persistent, they wouldn't let go. And the coconut was attached to a chain, and that's how they caught them. The curiosity was so fundamental to them that they had to know what that was. Wow. Maybe it's food, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's pretty glass or something, you know. And I used that as my opening thing.
That's fascinating.
Well, the professor was ecstatic over my essay.
Yeah.
And to my extreme embarrassment, he read it to the class.
I know that.
And I got an A from him.
Yeah.
But I wish I could remember his name, because he was a well-published poet.
We can find it.
English and American. He published a couple of books. I didn't realize he was, but he was English. He had an English accent. Mm-hmm. And we sat in that Quonset boiling together.
Wow.
Anyway.
So it's a varied experience, like every other
situation. Well, debating and public speaking dominated everything.
Yes, it sounds like that.
I wanted to take a serious philosophy class. And what was her name? Mendenhof? She'd been teaching philosophy there for years, and she was very good. And I had to hurry to keep up with her. She was very sophisticated on that.
Well, as you went
on. The football coach teaching me, and the girl bringing in, gee, I wish I could remember. Her first name was Rose. Maybe that was her last name. She was so beautiful. Wow. Anyway, the light of my life, I don't want to go into it.
Okay.
It's the girl that I spent most of my time, the one that got cut off on the award thing in the junior year with me. Her name was Sally Kay.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Pat Buckland and a couple of other people were good friends of mine. The people you walk home with.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of thing it was.
Yeah.
We all had long ways to go. And we could stop and get a Cherry Coke. If we hurried, we could grab a taco and eat it on the way. But we all had, most of us had jobs,
mm-hmm.
so we would head out. And Sally and I were very into the music of the day.
Okay.
Nat King Cole,
yeah.
Anita Simone. I could get some that are wrong that are earlier or later. What's the one that's still alive that's so wonderful? It is right off Central Park, and he's the most important male singer alive today in America.
Tony Bennett.
Yeah. Who I adore.
I've seen him at the Rainbow Room, actually.
I adore Tony Bennett.
Yeah.
He can still sing.
Yeah. Oh, he's
not
wonderful.
Not everything, and not as well, but it's he's 92 or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people say his favorite pastime, he lives on Central Park South, which faces the park.
I know.
And he takes his paintbrushes and his paints and his board, and he goes and sits in the park and paints.
Oh, he's supposed to be a good artist.
And the only time he doesn't do it is because too many people crowd around him.
Yeah.
Because he's not anonymous, exactly. Yeah. He is adored by the entertainment world.
Well,
he was a very important singer way back then. Of course, Frank Sinatra dominated everything.
Well, all that music of the 40s.
And who was the famous singer that retired and lived on Point Loma? An old Tom Polk was riding along his way. Yippee-i-yay, yippee-i-yo.
Frankie Lane,
yeah.
Frankie Lane, when he retired, he moved to San Diego and lived on Point Loma.
And
Sally Kay and I were huge fans of his. And we had a call-in radio program here where you could call in and request songs. They didn't always play them that night, but they would play them the next night. But we got to know the disc jockey, she and I. And we actually met him a couple of times. We were down at the station. So when we called in, we got what we wanted. Well, little did I know, but he took a liking to Sally Kay.
Oh.
And I didn't know about it. So when it came time to pick colleges, she said, I think I'm going to go to UCLA. And I said, oh, come on. Sally, you got to come to San Diego State, you know. I'm going to need you there. And she said, well, I can get programs at UCLA. They'd that I can't get at San Diego State, and I think I need to get away from family, and she had all these issues. Well, that wasn't it at all. It was the disc jockey had been transferred to L.A.,
oh, boy.
And he was on a radio station there, and they ended up getting married.
Oh, God.
I was heartbroken. Oh. It was very sad.
Yeah.
For about 6 months, I guess.
Yeah.
The only other was, oh, Marjorie Lee was her name in grammar school. I was madly in love with Marjorie Lee in the fourth and fifth and sixth grade, but it didn't go beyond that. And I had a friend who also liked her, and he was furious that I was getting more attention than he was. Anyway, my whole problem with getting involved too much was I can take the teaching job, and I can eventually get a PhD, and I'll have just enough money to maybe cover the costs of being married with one child, and that's not going to happen until I'm 35 or 40. Is that what I want to do with my life? And supposing, the thing doesn't work out. I've been there. I've seen that. I don't want to go down that road.
Right.
And that was a shield.
Yeah.
Especially after Sally ran off with the disc jockey.
The disc jockey.
And,
And,
you know, she was very close to me. Mm-hmm. I got to college, and the fraternity always had parties. There were plenty of women around, and they were interesting women, and the top fraternity got the top sorority, so we had really classy gals. We did some pretty terrible things to them. The Kappa Alpha Thetas were right next door to us, and we found out that if we crawled out on our roof in the evening, they had to be in by 11 o'clock on certain Friday, Saturday nights. There was a tree that hung over our property over their front porch. Mm. And then if we took a water balloon and we threw it into the tree, it would break and it would rain right on the front door. So all these girls being brought home by their boyfriends, you know, all dressed up to the nines, and they're just about to have their first goodnight kiss, and it suddenly rains from a clear sky. They were livid and they couldn't see where it came from. We were hiding on our roof, which was right over theirs. So we did some, now I really remember it. We had sorority parties in the fraternity house. We had a nice house, really nice house. And it was right there on Montezuma Road, next door to the Kappa Alpha Thetas. And it was a very attractive old Norman designed house. It was beautiful. And we were having a party with one of the more rowdy sororities. And we decided that we wanted to play a trick on them. So we had a women's powder room that we set up whenever we had a party with women coming in, and we recorded everything they said when they went into the powder room. And then when they left, we pulled it out and played it. And I've got to tell you, everybody but the victim never had such a hard life. These girls would be, you know, sweet and nice to somebody who was just boring or dull or said stupid things or something that annoyed her. And so she'd get in there and just rip them, you know, from one end to the other.
And you had it recorded?
Well, it wasn't very nice, and we had to stop it because the sorority really got mad. I mean, there were girls that were chasing a guy, but they got mad at him because he wasn't responding. So she tore into him, but she really wanted him. And now we're playing her tearing into him, and he's not going to have anything to do with her. We were breaking hearts all over them. It was really, I think we only did it two or three times. But it was hysterical. And things like that come flashing back to me.
Well, college, yeah.
The other one was Tony McPeak and I were the dishwashers. We set up the dining room table at 5:30 or 6 in the morning. Mm-hmm. We ate our meal then, and then we brought out the food for everybody. You know, they would rotate, and then they would dash off to their 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock class. And they would get in food fights. And we'd have to clean all this food, and it slid down the walls and was on the floors. It was not very often, but somebody would say something, and the other made somebody, they pretended to be mad. But then they went off to class, and Tony and I had to clean up the mess.
Wow.
And then we invented a song, because we had to wake up to 8 o'clock. So that was the first class. So we would open the door, and there'd be like, it's a great big room in the front of the house, so we had like six people in there sleeping. So we sang a song, "Good morning, morning glory, good morning now to you. You wake up with the flowers, or the birdies, like all good birdies do.
And we were seeing this off key in the most horrible way. And these people were all densely. We collected more shoes thrown at us. I mean, shut the door quickly, but you hear this bang, bang, bang. They all grabbed their shoes and started throwing them because we woke them up. But we had to wake them up. And we played other tricks on them, too. Tony and I had a lot of fun doing that.
It sounds like you had a lot of fun.
Well, I had, my fraternity only had a couple of bad eggs in it. You know, you never heard of a score every time. People that were problems, you know, they started bringing drugs in or they were bringing alcohol in when they weren't supposed to or something. And we didn't kick people out, but we let them know that they weren't welcome, that they were going to misbehave. But we were a very serious fraternity, mainly because we wanted to be first in grades. The university computed the grade average for each fraternity, and we absolutely wanted to be number one because we were trying to get a lot of athletes to join, and the best athletes in the high schools, that was important to them, that, well, I won't flunk out if I join Sigma Chi. And I gave the last two speeches at our nominating party. We invited the final group to a dinner party at a hotel, El Cortez. We used places really nice. And I gave a speech telling them why they shouldn't join any fraternity but Sigma Chi. But I had all the records. We had the highest grades. We had the most athletes.
Great.
We won intramural every year. We had the most politicians. I said, why would you want to join anybody else? Now, one or two of them would have a cousin or maybe a brother that was in another fraternity, and they would have to go. But anyway, it was a great fraternity. And then about 10 years later, a bunch of drunkards got a hold of it in a couple of years of rushing, and they destroyed it. So it's gone.
Now, as you thought about it, you were in college. I know that you said when you were younger, and I don't think we did it in this session, but when we were talking that how Clarence Darrow was your hero and you thought about going on to law school.
Well,
so from what I understand, you...
My heroes were Clarence Darrow and Eugene Debs.
Right.
Which is dangerous territory because he was a socialist. So I didn't push that very hard, but he was really out for the common man and the poverty-stricken and the down and out. And he planted the seeds, shall we say. And Clarence Darrow, toward the end of his life, he took on some cases for very wealthy people only because he didn't believe in the death penalty. And there was one terrible murder case, a three-point love affair in Hawaii. And the family had great wealth, and they hired him and paid him. He was retired, but they offered him like $100,000 to fly to Hawaii and keep their son from being executed. And because he didn't believe in the death sentence, he prevailed. And what was the famous one where the two teenage boys killed the child? The Sacramento, not Sacramento. Anyway, it doesn't matter. He protected them. They came from very rich families in Chicago.
I remember that.
And they ended up, one of them died in prison, and the other one eventually got out of it. Anyway, it was a very famous case.
Yes.
That was Clarence Darrow's most famous case.
Yeah.
And I followed everything about Clarence Darrow.
Yeah.
It's annoying when you can't remember. Yeah, but it's easy to find. You put in Clarence Darrow, and that case will come up first.
I know. So,
but I wanted to be the lawyer for the downtrodden.
Understand.
I mean, it was very melodramatic.
I understand that.
And I said, there's a lot of people that can't afford lawyers. In those days, not very many people paid attention. Now they do. The law firms, the schools are teaching them that they should, they give them all kinds of privileges too. If they'll sign up for 3 to 5 years of taking in people who can't afford a lawyer, they get perks and things. Anyway, that was really me, and that's one reason why I quit, really. At the end of the first year, the problem was about 40% of our class were Korean veterans.
So we have to make this transition now to law school. So you decided to go to Stanford.
Well, it's the most prestigious. Do you know the year that I went, four of the Supreme Court justices graduated from Stanford Law School. Never happened in the history and probably never will again. It's always Yale and Harvard, with rare exceptions. But to have four different, it was the woman from Arizona.
Sandra Day O'Connor.
Right. And the guy that was chief of staff of the thing was, I don't know if he was a Mormon or what, he had connections somewhere. Anyway, there were four of them. No question about it, you can check it out.
Yeah.
And of course, that The few kids that from San Diego State that went on to law school went to Bolt Hall at Berkeley.
Right.
But I was so taken with, first of all, I applied to, you know, five schools.
Right.
Nothing back east because I couldn't afford to travel. But I wanted to be sure I got in.
Yeah.
And when Stanford accepted me, I don't think they'd ever accepted anybody from San Diego. They not only accepted me, they gave me a fellowship,
right.
Stanley Petter Law Fellowship.
Great.
And they said, now this is a very wealthy lawyer from San Francisco who died, and his widow has set this thing up to honor him, and you're the first recipient. And because you're the first recipient, she lives down in Carmel, Monterey, we want you to go down and have tea with her and char her socks off.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it. He said, she's a very lovely lady, but she's, you know, a society lady. She's not going to be zippy. I said, well, of course I'll go down. I'm very grateful for this fellowship. So I went down and I had tea out on her terrace overlooking Carmel Monterey. I mean, the way some people live. And she and I struck it up. But by the end of the first year, I was miserable. 40% of my class were these mean Korean veterans who took 1 year of business school, and then they were headed straight for Wall Street. And
yeah.
They were all right-wingers.
Yeah.
And they had a very greedy attitude about the law. The law is to help you exploit things.
Mm.
And I just got more and more bitter. We had three women in the class. Now, this last year at Stanford is five more than half.
Oh, yes.
The women are taking over
all
the
labor over. Oh, all over. The,
they're not getting the jobs they should be getting, because I follow that closely with my lawyers. They're not getting, they should be hired by the top law firms, but it's very, very hard for them. If they're super cum laude, number one in their class, they'll get a good deal. But just being in the 98th or 99th percentile, the men get the breaks.
Yeah.
But that's going to change.
Oh, it's changing.
It will change.
It's changing.
Sanders, wasn't that his name, the third guy that ran for president? Sanders?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Sanders is a perfect example of what I think America will be 10 to 15 years from now. He's just too early. But he's planted the seeds. He had a lot of influence on Hillary to compromise some of her standings.
Right.
He certainly was used as a bludgeon by Donald Trump. He called him a communist and a socialist and all these terrible things. And he called himself a socialist.
Yeah.
But you wait till these next three or four generations come up. There won't be any more Donald Trumps, I'll tell you that. Anyway, I don't want to get into politics.
Right.
It's too painful right now.
Right. So at Stanford, you discovered, as you said, that it was kind of disillusioning. So then you got into an army situation.
Well, let me tell you what I did. The dean fought me tooth and nail. He said, Andrews, it isn't good for you to bail out as the first recipient. And I said, but I'm so unhappy. And I told him why.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we are overloaded with conservative students. There's no doubt about it. But they're very smart. I said, sure, they'll go to Wall Street and they'll all get rich. I don't like people like that. He said, I tell you what, let's bargain. You didn't want to be on Law Review. That wasn't what you were looking for. But there's moot court, and that's your bailiwick. Moot court is all oral.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, why don't you stick around for the second half of the second year at least and do moot court? Because I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Well, I felt so guilty about walking away after the first year, I came and told him I would do that. So I put my name on the list for moot court. Now, there's a very famous bank family in San Francisco, and I'm drawing a complete blank, but they had twin brothers who got into Stanford Law School, and they didn't have the swiftest oar in the water. But their family owned the bank chain,
mm-hmm.
and that was enough to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very nice guys. They were identical twins. And I drew out of a hat one of these twins for my partner for moot court.
Mm.
And then they assigned you a case that has been at least gone to the appellate court in California, or is about to, because one of the three judges that would hear moot court would be one of the actual judges on the appellate court in California. So then you've got a dean from Bolt, and you've got a dean from some other campus in the state, Hastings probably. And they come in and they hear your case and they pick the winner. Well, let me tell you the case, because it's just too juicy. A vice president of the Bank of America went on a convention to New York City a social banking convention. A lot of drinking, a lot of gambling, a lot of womanizing, and a few meetings and a few papers were read. So this guy picks up this gal, the one from San Francisco, who's the vice president of the bank in San Francisco, and he takes this woman back to his hotel. And their bed catches on fire and they both die. He did not smoke, but the woman that went home seemed to be a prostitute. She could have been a lawyer for all we know. Anyway, as far as we know, she's respectable. Everybody's drunk and you go home and go to bed. But she did smoke. So the question was, does the widow of the San Francisco judge have the right to sue for workman's compensation when he was not the direct, when he was peripheral? It was her fault, not his fault.
Right.
And the case had been heard by the appellate court in San Francisco, but it had not been released yet. Nobody knew what the decision was. So one of the judges, of the three judges I had when we presented our case, had heard that case, but he hadn't seen what happened, nor had their decision been applied. So we do what you do in law school. You look for cases that are what we call on point. So we went through, you had to go through a lot of books. Now you just use a computer to try to find a case that was similar enough to this one that would help you make a ruling.
Right, right.
Or argue a ruling.
Right.
We could not find anything in California.
Oh.
But I remember Dr. Hurlbut, who was our tort professor.
Yeah.
Brilliant man, an alcoholic very clearly, but he was brilliant. He taught a case in court law, and he told us the history of the workman's compensation law in California was based on La Follette's brilliant doctrine that he established in Wisconsin 50 years ago or something, where they broadened the definition and they looked for less exact points or whatever it was. So I said in desperation to my partner, I said, I think we have to go to Wisconsin on the records, not traveling.
Yeah, right.
So we went and we found a gameskeeper who was supposed to go in the off season for hunting out in the woods. People would shoot deer. And his job was to go out and try to catch them. So he took his girlfriend with him, and he had one of these dodges where you could lay the seat down and make a bed out of it. And so he had this car with the bed, and he turned on the music, and he turned on the heater, and they asphyxiated.
Oh.
So we had a case.
Oh.
And we had the way the court ruled, and it supported our side.
Terrific.
So when we presented that, we sat in on the earlier case that was being heard, and then we were there when, and Dr. Hurlbut came into the, this is one of those like medical lecture halls where it's like round and like that, and I remember Dr. Hurlbut coming through the door down in the corner very unobtrusively and sitting down. Now this was in the evening. He had no reason to be in the law school. So he had read our paper and realized that we had taken his lecture and we had applied it in a very creative way. So he wanted to hear how the judges handled that. And the judges just fell out of their chairs complimenting us. And then the judge who had been on the appellate court, he said, I want to tell you something. If you had presented the case with your backup, your point cases, we might have decided otherwise. Which is about as high a compliment as you could possibly get.
Right.
And Dr. Hurlbut was thrilled.
Wow, that's a great story.
And then, so I still left. But I also stayed a little longer because I opened the Cardinal, which is the student newspaper at Stanford, and it said, the Oxford University debate team is making their annual stop in the tour that they do in America. They stop at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Stanford and maybe someplace else. And they will be coming in a month, and we need people to sign up to be considered to defend the virtues of Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a letter with my resume, and they called me in and interviewed me and said, you're going to be one. We've got another guy who's got a very good record, too. And this is a hall that they have on campus that seats about 2,000 people. They used to show crazy movies from the 30s in this place, and all the students would come. So we went into that with the guys from Oxford, and they were very, they had wonderful wit. They were amusing themselves in a very British way,
yeah.
Very sort of upper class British,
right.
And droll and but charming and fun. So the whole thing turned out to be fun. We didn't try to beat the hell out of them, but we felt that we beat them. And of course, the audience was entirely on our side, whooping and hollering and everything. So it was a huge success. And then one day, shortly after that, I walked into the law building, and on the bulletin board was this announcement that the Army was desperate to find somebody to come and enlist immediately and come into staff judge advocate because the second lieutenant, who had been the assistant to the colonel, who was the judge, had an emergency family matter or something he had to drop out. And so suddenly, at the last minute, they don't have anybody to back up the colonel. And they said, we're going to Santa Clara Law School, Hastings, Bold, Stanford, and I think there was one other. And any students that's interested in dropping out right now and coming in and filling in this emergency, we will give you an extended Army Reserve program. You didn't have to go in for 3 years or something. I think you got in for 6 months, I don't know. So I signed up for it.
Ah.
And I got it.
Right.
So I went to the dean and I said, my country is calling me.
Yeah.
The Army needs me.
Oh.
I bet I could hide behind that, which wasn't really the reason I went at all. And then when they found out I could type 103 words a minute, which I've already told you.
Yes.
They put me in an air-conditioned room, twice the size of this, with a good law library, and I got to do all this secret tracking of things that were going on the four-door base. You can't put that in the thing there.
Well,
maybe we'll modify it, but I mean, I don't think I might get some nasty letters from the Army. I don't know. Anyway.
How long were you in the Army?
8 weeks of basic training. The only time I ever ordered coffee. And we were out at 4 o'clock in the morning, the coldest day almost in my life, to learn how to shoot rifles. 4 and 5 in the morning.
Oh.
And they had this cauldron, this gigantic bucket of black coffee. And I said, give me one of those, fill it to the top. And I held it to keep my hands warm.
Yeah.
And coffee smells good. I do like to smell coffee. But I didn't buy it to drink it. Mm-hmm. I bought it to keep warm. And I thought, well, this was handy. Anyway.
So, the Army turned out.
How long,
yeah.
I think it was 6 months that I was the colonel's aide, maybe longer. He had some real problems with undue influence by the general that ran the whole base. And it was very complex and a big major scandal. And I had to stay and do a lot of the paperwork on that. So I could have been there for 8 months, which means I was in the Army for about a year. I was required to show up for 2 weeks of reserve for the next 2 years, and then they told me I didn't have to come anymore. That's when things were lightening up in Vietnam and they didn't need as many people.
Yeah.
At one time they were desperate. And that's when I came back to San Diego and talked two fraternity brothers into renting an apartment on South Mission Beach, and we split it up three ways. We could afford it. And they were driving out to campus every day to go to classes, and they drove me out there, and I went out for my teaching.
Tell about that. You were teaching here, and you were also a debate coach.
Well, I was pressured to help the debate teams.
Yes.
And I liked doing that, and I was twirling my fingers as to what I wanted to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I was having a hard time deciding, do I want to go back to law school? Do I really want to get a PhD in forensics and debate?
Mm-hmm.
Do I just want to become a rare book dealer? I got some very good offers from some of the top rare book dealers, but they were only the West Coast. Now, they had two of the leading rare book dealers in the country, but one in LA and one in San Francisco. In New York, they had about 12.
Mm-hmm.
People that sell Gutenberg Bibles mm-hmm. for millions of dollars. It was a different game.
Yeah.
So I just knew I didn't want to live in New York, so I didn't pursue that until Francis offered me her store.
Right. But meanwhile, tomorrow we're going to be discussing the next steps that you took. But for today, is there anything else that you can?
Well, I would think that's where going over to
Pacific Beach and finding those letters that were worth thousands of dollars in this little ugly French desk that she had there, which was probably worth thousands of dollars, I don't know, and this gigantic rug that she had sticking out of her garage. I mean, she was such a sweet lady. She was completely overwhelmed. She probably had some very, very rich relatives three times removed because the stuff they sent her was just, you know, a gigantic carpet that might have been worth a lot of money, three or four pieces of furniture, a lot of china dishes, fancy. You could tell they were wealthy, but she didn't. She was bewildered.
Yeah.
But anyway, and finding those things opened doors to the rare book dealers on the highest level. I mean, the letter, that Overland Narrative, was sold to the Beinecke Library at Yale for the Coe Collection, which is the most famous Western travel history collection in America, strangely enough. Should have been in Bancroft. That's where it belonged. Bancroft had a good collection. But somebody, Mr. Coe, probably was a billionaire.
Well, I think that this has been a fascinating beginning of your journey, and tomorrow we're going to continue it.
What are we going to focus on tomorrow?
So tomorrow we're going to talk about Yale and Harry Ransom and all of that.
Okay.
And thank you.
That's a wonderful,
an exciting way to start.
And I-